Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Alex Birch. Alex is a partner with Veritas Equity Partners. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Christian. Happy to be here.
Oh, pleasure to have you. Wait, why don't we start with Veritas? What's the firm's investment thesis?
Yeah, so we're a multifamily apartment investing fund out here in the Seattle, Washington area. So we invest in strategic locations in Washington State only. So we're not in Seattle, we're in surrounding tertiary markets and then close by to the city, 20 to 30 minutes out. We buy workforce housing, median rent, kind of cosmetic light value add apartment deals.
Okay. So my background's in portfolio management. You know, I'm aware of the value of having different asset classes from a return perspective. But for the benefit of our audience, who may not be as familiar with real estate as an asset class, what's the logic and value of investing with a firm like Veritas?
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody talks about diversification. I think that's a really vague term. You know, it depends how you think about it. But if you're looking to get into real estate, I think having a relationship with a group like ours, where you're actually directly invested in assets, as opposed to something like a REIT or a blind fund or whatever that you don't have any visibility into, is powerful. So, you know, the way we put our deals together, we'll syndicate them, we'll do closed funds, we'll do various types of structures, but for the most part, you're directly invested in a specific deal that you could see. You could drive by it, you could Google it, you actually know what you're in, and you're a direct partner in an ownership level inside of those deals. I think it's super powerful.
Okay, so if we can unpack some of the color of the deals, I think it'd be valuable for listeners to get a sense of not only the asset from a diversification and ownership perspective, but just kind of like a yield. So, you know, if you have a lot of assets, there's cash flow and appreciation. When you guys are looking to structure deals, you know, what's first and foremost? Is it making sure that, you know, when it's all said and done, purchase and financing, that there is cash flow? Or, you know, are you happy to break even just to get into a building?
No, never happy to break even. So we look at it depending on the investor group as well. So we can be specific in terms of maybe there's some groups that are more focused on a tax shelter opportunity. Maybe there's more groups that are focused on cash flow. Maybe there's more groups that are focused on long-term equity gain and kind of net worth build. But in general, all of our deals touch all of those buckets regardless. So one might be tipped one way or the other, but they're all going to reflect all of those things. So each return model and metric and the way that we think about these things is really parsed out across those buckets. But they're generally all going to return a cash flow range in terms of a cash on cash return in the 6 to 9% a year range, and consider that sort of a dividend is how we talk to our investors about it. You're going to get that in terms of quarterly distributions. Sometimes the deals take 12 months to stabilize before we'll start those distributions, but oftentimes they'll start in the first quarter. In terms of an equity gain and net worth growth perspective, we are marching towards getting about a 1.75 to 2x multiple on the cash that was put in the deal. So if an investor puts $200,000 in, we'll operate these things for, you know, whether it's 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, business plan dictates that depending on the asset itself. But we're looking to sell the thing when we can get around a 1.75 to 2x on the cash in the deal. And then that third pillar along the way, we're doing tax advantage strategies, you know, whether that's cost segregation studies, just generalized depreciation, CapEx investments in the building, those types of things. So you're getting tax advantages along the way from day one as well. So we look at all those buckets.
All right. So I didn't hear you mention it, but while we're on the subject of tax, REITs, real estate investment trusts, I know my familiarity with it, that if you have a certain amount of shareholders within a REIT, and you pay out, I think it's at least 90% of rents to shareholders, there's an additional tax advantage. Is that something that you guys have explored yet? If not, how do you think about it?
So we do direct tax advantages in the building. So the way our deals are structured is investors have the exact same tax treatment as if they went off and bought the thing themselves, with an LLC that they created. So all of the depreciation that we're getting, whether that's just a standard, 27 and a half year depreciation schedule, or we're doing a cost segregation study and accelerating it, they're getting this their percentage of that depreciation based on their percentage of ownership in the deal, which is just directly related to how much cash they put into it. So, if we raise $2 million for a deal and somebody puts 200 grand in, they're going to get 10% of the depreciation that's available for that deal, and they can, do with it whatever is correct for their specific tax situation. If they're qualified real estate professionals, if they spend enough time in the game, they can scrape all of their W-2 income with it. They can take off other capital gains with it, all of that stuff. If it's purely passive and they're only in a couple deals and, it's not something that's kind of an income strategy for them, then there's rules around that, what they can and cannot do. So we just tell them to go to their CPA and figure that out. But there's no better tax situation in terms of real estate than directly investing in like a syndication or something like that.
Okay. One of the key parts of, I imagine, any deal is not only going to be the price, but financing and down payment. And as we're recording this today, it's mid-May 2025. I was reading earlier this morning, interest rates, residential mortgage rates continue to hover around 7%. I imagine they're a little bit higher, for investment properties. And so how does that impact, how you guys think about valuations, how you think about how much you have to put down, given what the bank is prepared to lend, and any other color that you can provide, knowing that I presume you're not, you're, or I presume you're financing these properties.
We finance. So this is something that all of my long-term mentors taught me from day one, is like the only way to really lose your shirt in this game is bad debt strategy. Getting into something that's too variable or too floating, or assuming that rates are going to come down or whatever, and then buying deals with those assumptions. So we are ultra conservative with debt. We only do what's called agency loans on these things. So it's Freddie, it's Fannie. They're government backed. You have to have a track record in the exact asset class to get these deals. You have to have a certain net worth, a certain liquidity requirements, like those things. It's a little trickier to get these loans. You can't just go get it if you've never bought an apartment deal before. But in fact, the rates are actually substantially better than residential loans. So we just got our most recent acquisition rate locked about 2 weeks ago at 5.84% fixed for 7 years. And that's interest only for 4 years, 3 years of principal and interest. And that's with about a 30% down payment. So, we're coming in with good, healthy down payment. Our leverage isn't too aggressive. We're not coming in and then doing any kind of mezzanine or bridge debt or variable debt on top of that. If the deal doesn't pencil for us from day one with the current debt in place and with the amount of cash that we have to raise for the deal, then we don't buy it.
And then, are there any additional stipulations for these types of loans that you have to manage to, covenants, net capital requirements, in order to maintain one with their life?
Some of them are a little, there's Freddie and Fannie are a little bit different, but there are sometimes they will hold back reserves amounts in terms of like monthly, they'll collect essentially like an escrow for CapEx or for operational expenses. Insurance needs to hit certain thresholds. So that's one piece that, we learned over time, but the insurance world is nuts. It has been for the last, year or two or whatever in terms of getting insurance. The rates are way higher. So that's something that we do right out of the gate. So when we get a deal sent to us, we never buy anything listed. That's not saying we never will, but just up to this point, over 15 years, we've got about $50, $60 million in assets under management in these things that we've bought that we're currently running. We've never bought anything listed. So we get the financials sent to us from whether it's owner groups that we know, relationships that we already have, broker relationships that we have. The very first thing I do is ship it off to our debt guy, who then crunches the numbers on the current financials on the thing to understand what the actual loan potential is going to be on it with the specific loan programs that we want. And then I ship it off to our insurance person, and she goes through and underwrites it and gets us insurance quotes. This is like before we even go through and do any kind of intense underwriting, or definitely before we get the deal under contract or anything like that. So we're actually coming in with real, hard numbers in terms of we know what the debt's going to be, we know what the insurance is going to cost, we know what, and then we go in and do our underwriting on rent proformas and expense ratios and all of that stuff. But we're doing that day one.
Okay. And what are the types of insurance that you're getting coverage on the buildings for?
So it's just, I mean, the same exact type of like liability, property and casualty. If we need like an umbrella policy, the deductible amounts have to meet certain thresholds. We have to get terrorism coverage. It's just all of those typical stuff that you would get on like a homeowner's policy. But for a commercial policy.
Okay. And then my next thought is you mentioned what I heard or inferred was an exit strategy, something you can share with your LPs. What's the scenario if someone doesn't want to sell? I guess, as I'm thinking about it, next question would be, is there an opportunity to do a 1031 exchange in these as well?
That's a good question.
If they want to avoid if they want to avoid taxes and they have no in they want to they prefer to hold on the property, just despite what the rest of the group would like to do.
Yeah. So ultimately, it's up to the general partners on the deal as to when we sell the deal. So, and that's all part of the operating docs. So LPs know that. We're very transparent with that. The operations of the building along the way, we don't have to get approval to replace a fridge, to fix a roof, none of that stuff from the investor base. And this isn't a syndicated deal. So, and that's typically what LPs, individual investors are wanting when they're investing in those things, is something that they don't have to be involved in, that it's just kind of mailbox money. And ultimately, they're going to multiply their money on the back end. If somebody is more interested in being like an operating partner, or creating like more of a joint venture, partnership, they'll need to bring a lot more money. And we'll have that conversation, and we'll put together, a specific entity with them.
Okay.
So that's just a different, it's a different structure.
Okay. 1031s. Have you guys found yourself doing any exchanges yet?
Yeah, so the first 13, 14 years I was doing this, the first apartment deal I got into was 2010. I was 22 years old, and I just multiplied my own portfolio, with some friends, with a little bit of family stuff, like, but you really just my own for 13, 14 years. And all we did was 1031. We started with 200,000 bucks and got into a little 8 unit in Seattle. And we literally just 1031, 1031, 1031, up and up and up, and built that portfolio to, being worth about $30 million. And over time, I was also working in tech, selling software,
Okay.
doing that on the side. So 1031 is like my favorite, one of my favorite elements of this whole business. It's a little bit, there's a little more nuance when you have like a syndication, with an investor base. If we have 15 LPs in a deal, all 15, basically the whole group needs to go to the next deal. So if we get to the finish line and we say, hey, we're ready to sell this thing, the initial equity that we raised for this was, $1.5 million. Today it's worth $2.6 million. Whenever we sell this thing after closing costs, we want to know if you guys want to all roll into the next deal. If like 15 out of 15 say yes, cool, we'll 1031 it and we'll go do that. If 13 out of 15 say yes and two want their money back, there's provisions that we put in the operating agreements, and like it's called the PPM documents, the private placement memorandum, kind of explaining what's the process to buy people out. Before we sell, we'll get together as a group. We'll say, hey, do we want to buy these two people out so we can then carry on in 1031 to the next? But if we can't get the whole crew to go, then it's a, hey, we're gonna take our money, we're gonna pay cap gains, and if you want to reinvest it, we'll go into another one.
Understood. I think I can infer the answer, but I'm going to ask. And so it sounds like you guys are managing everything, soup to nuts. Does that include selecting and managing the property manager? Doing the accounting on the owner statements. Before that, you get your LPs their mailbox money.
Yes, so that's a reason that LPs invest with us, is that we have the machine kind of built, for the different regions that we buy and operate in. So, like I said, we're really specific. So we're in Eastern Washington, we're in a certain county out here in Western Washington in the Seattle area, and we have property management set up in terms of like hubs in these different places, so we can buy deals and just sort of drop them in. And our operating model's already fleshed out; it's already proven. The managers that we have in those regions know what we're trying to do and accomplish. So that's all good. Our bookkeeping is all centralized on the back end. Everything down to obviously monthly bookkeeping and monthly reporting, but also things like K-1s and tax returns and all of that stuff. We've got that machine pretty well built. So that's an advantage to investing with us. People don't have to monkey with it.
Okay. Would love to know your opinion when it comes to tenant leases. Do you guys typically go year to year, month to month? And also would love to know whether or not you'll ever Airbnb any units.
Yeah, so we always prefer 12-month leases. So our process around lease strategy is, these are 90-day closing windows when you get something under contract before you actually take it over. So we will buy something within those first 90 days, though, before we even own it. We'll already be in the ear of the current owners that we're working with, and sometimes they'll let us engage with their property managers directly before we even own the thing, and we'll tell them like, "Hey, don't renew any 12-month leases starting now, because we want to have control over that strategy when we get the building over." So, most of our acquisitions are our target is between $3 and $10 million purchase prices. So, we're not going out and buying mega complexes that are 250 units. Like in our area, our typical acquisition is like 15 to 50 doors, like 15 to 50 unit buildings. So it's not like there's, 300 units to have to be strategic around from the beginning. We look at the thing and we say, "Hey, there's 25 units at this. This is a $5 million purchase." We know that these 10 units are coming up in terms of their leases are expiring in the next 90 days. Leave them alone. And then we'll come in and we'll initiate our kind of leasing strategy. What we bump them to, if we think that's going to get somebody to move out, if they're going to stay, if we'd rather go slow or fast, it's up to us. But it's all kind of pre-planned down to the month, for the first 18 months after we buy it.
Got it. And then on the
Yeah.
subject of Airbnb.
Yeah, it's just not, I don't, for us at least, it's not super scalable. So I've thought about, converting a couple of our things to short-term housing, but really the shortest thing that we've really genuinely considered would be like 3 or 6 month leases in something that's like fully furnished and doing like a corporate housing play or something. If the market would support that, if there are contractors coming into certain pockets for 3 months at a time or something. But it's just not the delta just isn't really there for like the management burden that it creates. So you can look at a unit and say, "Hey, we're going to get $2,000 a month in rent for this 2-bed, 1-bath," and we could get $3,000 or $3,500 a month if we were to do short term on this. But the turn cost, the cleaning, the cost of furnishing it, like all of these things just sort of eat up all the delta. And I'm like, man, that's just a lot of work, if we were to try to do that over time. So it's just not scalable.
Understood. If we could take a step back for a moment, you referenced that. You started your career in investing in residential properties a long time ago, but if you can, walk us through your career progression, and how you got to Veritas, that'd be great.
Yeah, so I was just always curious about money as a kid. And so, nobody in my family was doing this at all, really. And nobody was even self-employed, let alone, investing in stuff like this on the side. I just was curious. So started reading books, learning, talking to people, interviewing people, finding mentors when I was, 18, 19, 20, 21. And I had when I was 22, so like I said, coming out of college, put together some of my money, some other people's money, and we bought this first little 8-unit building. And it was in Seattle. It was kind of at this, the crash, but I was 22. So like I didn't have any money that I lost during that, like I didn't have any experience. I just figured it was going to come back. And so, just from researching history basically. And so like I'm some deep level historian. I was just like, "Oh, this seems really low. Everybody's scared. I guess that, this is when Buffett says to buy." And so we got into that one. I was self-managing it. I was also selling at that time, I was selling payroll software. So like it was a really gritty job, like door knocking small businesses, like selling payroll services. And I was doing the apartment stuff on the side. And so, I self-managed that for a couple of years. We ended up doing a refinance, pulling $500,000 out, getting all the money we put into the thing back, going and buying like a 5-unit, in the same kind of area, doing it again, buying a 12 unit. This whole time I'm progressing in, W-2 software sales. And I was just doing that on the side. And so, fast forward to 2023 or 2020, I guess the beginning of 2024, and I've had some wonderful mentors that were in my ear for, at least 5 years that were like, "Hey, what are you doing? Being in the software world, like you figured out this cool little real estate machine, like you should be going and all in on that." And I was like, "Well, I feel like I am, because I'm putting all my money into it and, building out this thing and doing it on this." It was working really well. And finally, I think I got the gumption to go do this. So I actually created Veritas Equity Partners with my now business partner, and we started raising investor capital and just rinse and repeating, doing more of the same that we'd already been doing. So, the business model is the same thing that I had kind of stumbled over and figured out, with my own money and my own time for 13 years. And now instead of, one, maybe two deals a year, we're doing like 6 to 8. And so it's been super fun. I'm not really having to learn like a new business model because we've done it for so long, but learning the, raising investor capital and structuring those things and all of that has been, a fun learning process the last year and a half.
Great. So fast forward today, imagine your whole host of key lessons that you learned. Hear you loud and clear on, the debt structure going into a purchase. But what else is top of mind that, maybe has been a, hard lesson to learn, but or, maybe it was just clear from day one. But, any key takeaways you can share with us?
Yeah, I think listening to your gut's super important. Your gut gets better as you learn more, so it's not super helpful in the beginning, but if something seems too good to be true, it probably is. All the basics, right? I mean, like that's what I love about this business, compared to something like tech. So my last tech job, I ran a region in the sales org for AWS for Amazon Web Services, and it was a great job. Really, really smart people work there. But I feel like most people in that world are generally confused, like at least half the time. Like there's just so much going on with AI and machine learning and large language models and all of the different software stack stuff that changes constantly. And like it's just a lot. And you never are fully understanding anything because it's changing so much. Like the beautiful part about real estate and a lot of finance in general is that those models are, I mean, they're largely principle based. They're not changing a ton all the time. I mean, there's different ways to do it, but you have to just learn some key basics and just rinse and repeat and then refine over time. And so, I'd say learn as much as you possibly can, get some really great mentors that have been there, done that, that can kind of help you see around corners. But the biggest lesson, I guess, that I had is once you're about 80% sure, just go. Like just go do it. Like it's you're never going to feel 100% on anything. It's not going to be perfect. But as long as you're doing the fundamental stuff correctly, if you get three quarters of the way there, just go and do it.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. So back to Veritas. I heard here how your sourcing deals great. And I think you've hit on a lot of the due diligence. But any other lenses that when you look at deals that you consider when you're looking through that you consider?
Yeah, I think it's specific to like apartment investing, and I guess this would also apply if you were buying like duplexes and stuff. Understanding who you're buying from is super important. If you're buying from a really sophisticated group, we look a million times harder, for like the gotchas, just because if somebody's been doing it for 20 years and they know it, they've probably juiced everything that they can out of that deal. Like the rents are probably where they should be. You can do this with market data and see that pretty quickly too. But even little things like you've got to understand who you're buying from, because some groups are kind of known for being slumlords. Some groups are known for band-aids over things that should have been fixed more thoroughly. We're talking water damage, we're talking electrical stuff, and then there's also mom and pops that do a really amazing job, and they take a lot of pride in what they have, but maybe their operations aren't that slick in terms of getting the right rents, or maybe their expenses are high because they pour so much love into the building, and like these things aren't bad. You just have to know because you're underwriting, it can't be theirs.
And so, how does that translate from a portfolio perspective? Are you focusing predominantly on Class A or B?
BC.
You see
Yeah,
it.
BC. We don't Class A stuff, at least in our market. What we found is in most markets across the country, but particularly markets where there's a lot of money, Class A stuff is very thin. Like the margins are just thin. The groups that are operating those and have been for 20 years are good. The property managers that are managing those are good. People buying them are sharp, like, and they're usually like Wall Street people, like fund managers, family offices, like whatever it is. So, they're sharpening their pencils on everything that they possibly can, and they've been doing that for decades. So a lot of times those deals are more about market timing, which is tough to do. Right now I think it's a great time to buy anything. As long as it makes sense, like you've got to underwrite it and have diligence, right? But A lot of those are kind of reliant on cap rate compression or interest rates coming down and those types of things. And we just don't want to live in that world, you know. Like, we want to have a couple different contingency plans. We want to know that we can control the appreciation a little bit. And we want to know that we're going to come in and find inefficiencies quickly. And so we stay in that BC, you know, that sub $10 million purchase price range, for that exact reason.
Do you feel as if the strategy was long-term buy and hold, you'd be more inclined to look at A?
I think if our return expectations were less, then we would look there.
Hmm.
It's just, I think it's just harder to, like, our historical average is stupid high. It's like 30, 31% a year. When we go back and audit our deals, it's really high. So we don't promise that to anybody. That's not like an expectation. The market was awesome. You know, there was a couple cycles we hit, like all of that stuff. I mean, you could buy anything in some of these. Like in 2010, you could have bought anything and probably made a 15% of your return on that deal, you know, over the next 7 years, regardless of what it was. You know, that extra 15, though, is probably from our operational stuff that were just good. But when market's not cranking, that, you know, what we're looking for is a 15 plus percent a year annualized return. And, you know, if the market does do better, then it gets better. But that's what we're looking for.
Makes good sense. Prop tech, you know, just asset class amongst a number of early stage verticals that are getting attention. You have a unique background. Used to work in tech. You know, how do you guys think about leveraging technology to optimize the business? And you know, without revealing any trade secrets, you can use any examples of
Yeah.
tools that you're using today that you find really valuable. Would love to hear.
Yeah, it's the real estate world, in my opinion, is probably one of the most archaic from like a technology perspective. So it's really interesting because, you know, what I always used to do, because this was, again, coming from the tech world, especially I was at a handful of startups before AWS. It's one thing to have like a really cool piece of technology. It's another thing for it to be actually functional and useful. You know, and somebody could create the coolest, slickest tool that does the coolest, slickest thing, but if it's not actually functional and you can't actually implement it or you can't actually utilize it, like, who cares? You know, it doesn't matter. So no matter what, I think for now in this game, it's a people business. You know, you've got to have the relationships. You're still buying from people, you know, like that the purchase process, vetting the deals, negotiating the deals, you know, going in and actually making sure these things aren't going to have mold issues and foundation issues and all this stuff. Like, you can't outsource that with technology yet. I don't know if you ever can. Maybe, I'm sure something will happen that it can. Where we're looking for efficiencies with technology is more in like the property management side, the asset management side, how we interact with tenants, you know, how our financials flow every month, that kind of stuff. And I think that we are advanced from that perspective, like even down to property management software suites. I mean, there's a few juggernauts that everybody seems to have, but in my opinion, there's a few up and comers that are substantially better, you know, in terms of like the actual workflow, the usability for the tenants, and then, you know, accounting, the actual asset management piece, the reporting piece, all of that. So yes, we are trying to find, and we are finding tools that seem to be better than what, you know, 90 plus percent of like the big shops are using, but we are constantly looking into that all the time.
That makes good sense. You know, it's interesting you touch on the tenants. And so in any portfolio, you know, obviously you have to manage default risk. The names are escaping me, but you know, in the last couple of months I've read about software solutions that are, you know, are basically, you know, giving incentives to tenants to make sure that they can meet their lease commitment. You know, obviously the world is changing in lots of different ways. You guys ever you get involved with, you know, once a lease is signed and making sure that you're passing along additional value to your tenants to make sure that they fulfill their obligations?
Yeah, so what we have found works, and again, these things are simple, right? Like, and that's what I love about this business in general, is there's nothing that's like gonna blow your mind, you know, that like anybody's gonna say. It's just a bunch of little things that add up to really good, strong efficiencies. We offer tenants discounts if they put their rent on auto pay. Again, going back to that portal thing, just having something that's, you know, when you buy a building, you're transitioning it, you know, 95% of the time, we're not using the same property managers that were before. So there's a big transition period. it's interesting. There are still property managers out there that are pure paper. You know, I mean, we'll get boxes of paper leases. They collect checks. They collect cash. You know, like it's crazy. And so we then import that into our thing. We go back to the tenants and we say, hey, we're no longer allowing checks. We're just not. You know, like we're no longer, definitely not allowing cash. Like you have to pay electronically. Then it comes down to that the portals and the tools that we're using for them to actually do it, you know, and for it to be useful. Not all people are technologically savvy. Not all people like to use technology, you know, like we're aware of that. We just don't really make it a choice, and we also give incentives to do it. So we'll give rent discounts if somebody does it in the first couple of weeks, you know, after we transition the building. If they get on auto pay, whether it's an ACH, they can even use credit cards, like whatever they want, right? Like then we'll give them even more discounts, you know, and it's just little things like that. I think making it actually work is where our focus is at. But you know, we've seen some tools out there where, you know, there's companies that are taking tenant security deposits and investing them in some accounts, and then the tenants are getting, you know, rental credits, or maybe their security deposit's growing and they're getting the delta on that. There's some stuff coming that's interesting that we're paying close attention to. Again, though, I'm just always focused on what actually moves the needle, you know, what actually works. What actually makes people happy, not just like a cool, nice to have thing. And we're just trying to be laser focused on that stuff.
Makes good sense. Because you're focused on B and C, how often do you find you're having to make improvements in order to get all the units leased?
Yeah, so this is where like the art and the science of it comes to play that we think is, it is like my favorite part of it is, you know, you can underwrite a deal all day long. And this is where, for anybody that's looking to invest with like a fund or with a syndicator or whatever, vetting the operator is super important. I don't think there's a better way to vet an operator than to understand how they got to where they are. And if they've only ever been like a capital allocator, you know, like a syndicator or a fund manager or whatever, I would ask a lot more questions than somebody that like earned their stripes, like doing it with their own money and building their own portfolio and, you know, doing that self-management part, you know, getting really kind of gritty about it, right? Because you don't really know. So in the deals that we buy, we underwrite them and we say, hey, market rent for this region and this specific zip code down to a 1 mile pocket radius for where these buildings are, this class of building, this square footage, this bedroom bathroom count, what is the market rent? And we'll look at like the 25th percentile to the 75th percentile. We'll also pay attention to the 90th percentile, obviously, because we want to know what the delta is. But we are only buying deals that our pro forma works at the median rent level. You know, so for example, in our area, it's 3,000 a month gets you a 2-bed, 1 bath. 2,000 a month gets you that's Class A, 3,000 a month, really brand new, super nice builds. 2,000 a month is where we want to be for our pro forma rents. A building that we would buy would probably be in the $1,600 to $1,700 a month range today. You know, so we're not going crazy. We don't need $1,000 a month increases. And we could get there over 2 or 3 years. We're not gouging people. We're not coming in and cranking their rent. Like it's just like a 5 to 7% increase, maybe a 5 to 7% again. And then we're there. And then we just kind of do cost of living increases over time. We won't buy it unless that happens. So usually we'll do some kind of renovations to get there, but sometimes it's just purely like an operational play. And we'll just do it over time and not need to. Yeah.
I know you're focused on the Pacific Northwest, and so you're welcome to reserve your judgment for the region, but what do you see on the horizon for the market?
I think it's super market dependent. I think a lot of people went out and became overnight syndicators and fund managers, you know, in 2019, 2020, 2021. And went and bought in the places where people were fleeing to, you know, during COVID, Arizona, Texas, Florida, those types of markets, because you could chase more units. You know, there was all this hype about the markets. And if they got in and got out, good for them, you know, and everything went crazy. But there's a lot of people that are sitting on deals that are now underwater. Their debts come and due. You know, these loans are 3, 5, 7 years. No one really, I mean, not that many people do 10-year debt anymore in these things, but mostly it's 5 years is the most common in terms of fixed rate. And so, you know, where we're sitting right now is a lot of those purchases, 2020, 2021, 2022, their debt's coming due and they're underwater. Like they're going to have to do what's called a cash in refinance, which is a capital call to their investor base, which is not good. You know, the deals are not, they're not appreciated anymore. they needed 3.5% debt rates to cash flow. Most debt, like you said earlier, 6.5%, 7% right now. Not every operator can get those agency loans that we talked about. They'll still need 30% kind of minimum equity in the deals to get those. So I think there's going to be, and there already is starting to be, a lot of turmoil in those markets. In our market, though, this is why we stick here and we just know it. Like, you can't build any more out here without tearing something down. Like, there's no land. There's no urban sprawl possible unless you start going over a mountain pass, like, and then you get into, it's a totally different part of the world, basically, for as far as Washington State goes. But when you're thinking core Seattle area, the tech hub out here is crazy. We've got Microsoft, we've got Amazon, we've got Boeing, we've got Zillow, we've got, I mean, it's just, the list goes on in terms of like the humongous companies that are headquartered here. The inflow of people's not changing. The need for affordable housing is just going crazy. It's just up and up and up. And there's nowhere to build. So, for our trying to acquire everything that fits our thesis, that, meets our underwriting criteria that we possibly can for the next 5 years in pockets that we're already in. And I just don't see a world where that's a bad idea.
Said another way, geography is core to fundamentals.
It's huge. Yeah, it's huge. And if you're going somewhere that's just kind of slim and sexy for a minute, like, it's kind of scary to me. I think you should stay in core markets that you understand really, really well, that you can buy assets that make sense, that are going to make sense 15, 20 years from now.
Totally makes sense. Alex, great podcast. Before we wrap up, a couple more questions. One of my favorite go-to is kind of a retrospective. And so, if you had an opportunity to go back, have a conversation with your younger self, you pick the age. What would you share?
I think that I would fight the old imposter syndrome, a little more aggressively when I was younger. Like, I'm proud of myself in terms of what I was doing and what I was getting myself into when I was younger. But I would have done it even faster and sooner, with more confidence. Just because you're the youngest in the room, or just because you haven't done it a ton before, like, doesn't mean you're not good. I think the crawl, walk, run thing is important. Like, you start kind of slow and then you build up your momentum and go. But the second that you're competent and you're able, you should just go. And I would say just have more confidence in that younger.
I love it. Agree. And I think your crawl, walk, run analogy is a great one.
Thank you.
Sometimes we put undue pressure on ourselves because we see people sprinting and we're like, oh, not realizing that, hey, they had to start someplace too, and it wasn't.
Yeah. And they're already kind of, at the, not the finish line maybe, but they're already close and they've already been through all of the stuff. And no, and that's why it was just a triangulation I got from, very successful mentors that I have that are like, just go, like, just do it. 'Cause most of your learnings are going to be once you're already doing the thing, it's not going to be information that you glean off something before you do it. So just go.
Action creates opportunity. I agree 100%.
Love that. That's great.
If there was a another guest you'd like to see on the Innovators and Investors podcast, anyone, who would you like to see?
Wow, that's really interesting. I will say more of like a persona than like a like an actual person. I think it's really interesting to talk to somebody that got really, really, really big and then went bust, and then are on their way back, or maybe they've made it back again. I think those conversations, learning. It's sort of like this concept of anti-mentor. It's really aggressive, like that term, but I just have this belief that you can learn something from everybody, and whether it's what to do or what not to do, both are extremely valuable. And I think in sometimes it's learning what not to do is more valuable, than learning what to do. And so I think finding somebody, and I'm talking somebody that got like big, like, felt like they were untouchable, and then got crushed by something, right? Like, it's those, and having a focused conversation on that is super interesting. So I would say
All right.
that.
Homework accepted. I'm going to ask the team
Yep.
to see who they can find, and we'll see if we can't get them on here. But I think, it's a great point. Yeah, I mean, we learn so much when we don't succeed, as you point out, what not to do. But you're right. These stories, when you hear someone, hit unicorn status, and then it unravels, you're, I admit, I'm fascinating to understand what happened.
Yeah, for sure.
Good stuff. If any of our listeners want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Think our website's the easiest way. It's veritasequitypartners.com. So that's, I mean, phone numbers are there, email addresses are there, contact page is there. So that's the place.
Perfect. With that, Alex, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. And again, for benefit of our audience, Alex Birch, partner of Veritas Equity Partners. Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you are a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.